Welcome to the History Hotline, a direct line to a better understanding of all things Black history and beyond. Everyone, and welcome to episode 132 of the History Hotline. My name is Deanna Lynn Cook, and as always, I'll be your host. Today's episode is titled Vibes Cartel and the Privy Council. We're remaining within the space of Jamaica and looking at some Jamaican history and some contemporary issues within Jamaica's judicial system this week as we think about Vibes Cartel, who is a Jamaican dancehall artist, real name Adija Palmer. Now, on Thursday, the 14th of March, in a landmark decision, the UK's Privy Council overturned the murder conviction of Vibes Cartel, impacting also the ruling on the three co-defendants that he was found guilty with, Sean Campbell, Kahira Jones, and Andre St. John. It was overturned due to findings that the original conviction was compromised due to juror misconduct, specifically in relation to allegations of bribery during the original trial in 2014. Vibes Cartel at this point has been in prison since 2011, was convicted of the murder of a man called Clive Williams, also known as Lizard, and it was one of, or historically known as one of Jamaica's longest trials, going over 60 days, I believe. The UK Privy Council's decision, which obviously happened on Thursday the 14th of March, does not now necessarily mean he is automatically free or freed, but it does mean it remits the case to Jamaica's Court of Appeal to decide whether or not they'll grant a retrial. Now, in case you're confused, the History Hotline has not become a true crime podcast, do not worry, and this episode will not be about debating whether or not Vibes Cartel is guilty of the alleged crimes. I wasn't there. I don't know. And I'm also not a lawyer. So this case is going to have, you know, the historical contextual leanings that I always provide. But it will answer the big question that I have on my mind, which is why did this case go to the UK Privy Council? Or otherwise put, why is Jamaica's highest court or highest arm of like judicial ruling the UK Privy Council? Privy Council just sounds so, like, old as well. Old, wow, said the historian. It just sounds so quaint and English and colonial. That's the word I was looking for, Privy Council. But Jamaica's highest court is the Privy Council. It's the highest tier of the Jamaican court system. It's the fifth tier and the highest tier. The justice system in Jamaica is actually based on English common law. Obviously, it... These things all happened during this period of independence, question mark, but also that period in Jamaican history whereby Britain are still very much ruling and governing the island, but they are slowly moving towards independence. But obviously, it being a British colony, there's going to be large parts of the kind of English framework and the way things were done in England that are going to loom large within the legacy of Jamaica. It's very clear that the colonial presence on the island is still very real through this Privy Council and the fact that they are still in charge. So this episode is for the history lovers, of course. It's for those that maybe do like a bit of true crime. Also, maybe for the fans of Vibes Cartel or those wondering, you know, what actually happened with that case, because I think it is quite prominent within popular culture to hear things like Free Vibes or to think about him being in prison, obviously still releasing music, obviously still being so influential in the dancehall scene. And actually, this episode, whilst it's not necessarily going to go into the ins and outs of the case, it will definitely get into some of the reasons why this went to the Privy Council in the first place in regards to the juror misconduct. So if any of those things interest you, this is the episode for you. Tune in feel free, if you're new here, to go back and listen to past episodes. We lay out all the groundwork for these episodes in terms of the context of the Caribbean, colonialism, what's happening in Jamaica in regards to its independence and its break from Britain by way of becoming a republic. Those are some episodes that I've done before. They kind of link into today's episode. They aren't essential listening to understand today's though, so I let you off. You don't have to go all the way back. Anyway, back to the Privy Council. Now you might be thinking, well, if Jamaica's highest arm of, you know, law is not the Privy Council, then what would it be? And I'm here to give you the alternative, the Caribbean Court of Justice, which I'm going to call the CCJ from now on because a lot of mouthfuls. The CCJ is the Regional Judicial Tribunal, established in February 2001. During the period from then to now, Caribbean nations have decided, those that were colonized by Britain and have the Privy Council as their highest arm of the justice system, to replace the Privy Council with the CCJ through either referendums or whatever their own channels of debate with elected members of government or higher office are. It's a conversation that's been ongoing, and when I was like thinking about the CCJ and it being an alternative, I found this lecture series at Gresham College, by Leslie Thomas QC, and was speaking about the fact that actually having the Privy Council as a highest court remains a controversial political issue in the Caribbean to this day, because it has such deep colonial and imperial roots. And it's argued on the flip side of that, though, it does sometimes provide a very important safeguard for fundamental rights in the Caribbean. I'm hearing very paternalistic, Caribbean people can't do it for themselves kind of language, but I'm going to reserve complete judgment. But I'll talk a little bit more about what the kind of pros and cons are of Jamaica potentially adopting a different system within the CCJ as opposed to the Privy Council. And then we'll get into Vybz Kartel and the situation that's happening with his case and what the Privy Council have ruled and why they've ruled what they've ruled. That's a bit of a lineup for today's episode. So in the context of Jamaica and the Privy Council and the CCJ, it actually has been part of conversation, you know, for a while. And an example of this coming from 2012, when the then PMP leader and Prime Minister, former Prime Minister, Portia Simpson Miller, pledged in her swearing-in ceremony to, you know, have that start that conversation about removing the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council as Jamaica's final court of appeal. So, as I said, the replacement would have been the CCJ, which is a Trinidadian-based court, and it's actually hailed and quite a well-lauded and celebrated mode for international courts. So I'm saying this to say there is an available alternative to the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council. The Judicial Committee of the Privy Council is like the full title of the Privy Council, but I've just been saying Privy Council because there's just too many words. And conversations about this switch, you know, aren't just happening in Jamaica, they're happening in other Caribbean countries, although the CCJ is already the highest arm of the legal system in a few formerly colonised by Britain Caribbean islands and countries. So I wanted to talk through some of the pros and cons of the CCJ. And I think the main one, and I think what we'll realise as we get through this episode, is that the cost and the accessibility to the Privy Council is very limiting. And to have that as the highest court of the legal system in Jamaica really does limit who can access this part of the justice system. So the cost of going to the Privy Council is astronomical in many cases because the court is based in the UK. So citizens from countries like Jamaica and Guyana in particular, when we're thinking about these Caribbean countries, require visas to visit the UK. The costs are A, lot, and B, they're quite hard to come by, as in actually being granted said visa because of the UK Home Office and the way that they process visas and the way that they have interesting prejudices, especially against Jamaica and other Caribbean countries. So these visas can range from anywhere to £85 to around, I think it's 737. And I actually think these figures were from 2022. So these actually might not be accurate anymore. I don't think anything in the UK has gone down in the past like 5 years. So just expect it to be more. Which in US dollars, if you are listening stateside, you know, it's pushing $1,000 just for the visa. Now, we're already in another country, so flights. Flying a 10-hour flight, potentially with a stopover in the US, again, another visa requirement, potentially. And depending on the type of visa you need, all the other complications and issues that might need to be overcome when dealing with the Home Office, that is already one huge barrier. Also, and I want to say this bit again, very loudly, the Home Office don't like giving visas to Jamaicans. I'm just going to say that. Maybe that's fake news, but from my perspective, it's very, very difficult for Jamaican people to get visas. We've seen, you know, issues with deportations and the Home Office when it comes to things like the Windrush scandal. Well, you know, I feel like I don't need to say too much more. But it's quite an exclusionary process, I think, especially for Jamaican people, based on stereotypical criminal behaviours that they've attached to Jamaican people. Finding lawyers is another difficulty. Lawyers need to be trained in, or licensed as well, to practice in the UK, know the UK system, and obviously, you know, be well versed in dealing with the Privy Council. Which means them lawyers are probably British, born and raised and educated, should I say, more importantly, in the UK, and working for firms in the UK as well a lot of the time. So not only then is money leaving the country, you're not paying for a Jamaican lawyer, you're paying for a UK-based lawyer. So that's more money going into the UK, into UK-based firms. You know, this colonialism, it looms large. All of these costs add up, you know. The Jamaican dollar doesn't stretch very far in the context of Britain or any other Caribbean country. The dollar is worth a lot less. So not only, you know, you're dealing with quite high and expensive legal costs, travel costs, visa costs, you know, you're also at a disadvantage because your currency, the currency that you are paid in or that you earn in, is already weaker. This means that typically the only people who can afford to take their cases to the Privy Council are very wealthy, or with very high-profile cases, i.e. Vibes Cartel, or sometimes where cases are inmates on death row and able to secure pro bono legal services from British barristers, which historically has happened a few times. Those cases are the ones that tend to make it to the Privy Council. And, you know, I think it's important to note all this, even in the context of Vibes Cartel, where financially I am sure he is able to afford to be able to do this as an artist, currently producing music. I don't know what the legal ramifications are of him producing music and making money whilst being in prison, but I'm not going to say much more about that. He has been able to afford to do this. This is what's happening. Contrastingly, the Caribbean Court of Justice, the CCJ, is willing to sit in any country within its jurisdiction, which means that even though it's based in Trinidad, which is a simple stone's throw away from Jamaica, it will sit anywhere it is authorised and has sat on cases in Barbados, Belize, Guyana, Jamaica, and of course in Trinidad and Tobago where its seat is, which means it is exceptionally more accessible to those that need it. It's also much more flexible when it comes to allowing evidence to be given via video link as opposed to in person, which again lessens already much lower costs. And also, the CCJ tends to cover a lot of its own costs when travelling within its jurisdiction. I think personally, when it comes to a justice system, it should be accessible to a majority. And right now, I believe that the Privy Council is simply quite inaccessible due to cost and location to the majority. That being said, it's not the majority of the island or people on the island that need to access the Privy Council. Not many people in their lifetime need to go to the highest arm of the legal system, which obviously is a great thing. So that's why I would say this isn't like a pressing issue when you think about other things that Jamaica might be going through in terms of cost of living, in terms of other major issues that are really pressing at the present. That being said, when it comes to a case like this, you know, it's time to, I think, raise these questions and have these conversations as to why an alternative to the Privy Council has not yet been granted. Okay, so just laying that context there, let that sit and wash in your mind, and we're heading back to Mr. DJ Palmer and co, because I think it's interesting the way that popular culture has taken on this case, especially when it comes to the Jamaican diaspora in Britain. I think that is probably going to be the largest listener base of this episode, but I might be wrong. I'll find out soon. But, you know, there are always things going round, whether it be on social media or, you know, if you're in a club and a Vibes Cartel song comes on, there's a tendency to say things like free vibes. And I wondered how much people actually know about the case. They know about what happened. Truly believe that that is what should happen, or if it is just an element of pop culture, something that just gets said. And I don't know the answer to that. I kind of have heard and seen both sides of that argument, I think. But when I get into this trial, it was a trial for murder, and it was a long trial. It was 60 days long, which is one of the longest trials in Jamaican history. Vibes Cartel has been in prison since his arrest in 2011 for the murder of Clive Lizard Williams, whose body was never found. Throughout the years, he has proclaimed his innocence and has consistently fought to have convictions thrown out, taking it to lower levels of appeal and, you know, going through the judicial system in order to have these convictions overturned. The comments made following the Privy Council's decision, which was to overturn and to take it back to Jamaica essentially for a retrial, in very simple terms. Questions have been coming into play as to whether the Jamaican court trial process was equipped to handle a very complex murder case like the one in question, in a manner that was just, which is exactly what the legal system is supposed to do. During the 2014 murder trial, a juror had allegedly attempted to bribe others, offering $500,000 to acquit Vibes Cartel. Now, this happened 8 weeks into the trial. A juror who's known as Juror X attempted to bribe other members of the jury. The jury forewoman was questioned by the judge, and she said the juror was bribing jury members to acquit the appellant, i.e. find them not guilty. However, this happened really late in the day, and this is what the judge's kind of response was in, essentially allowing for the trial to continue without necessarily getting rid of all the jurors who had, you know, not necessarily taken the bribe, but had been witness to this and bore witness to it. The case continued, and it gave them a majority 10-1 vote to find them guilty, and a fifth member was acquitted, a fifth member of those convicted in 2014. Juror X was also found guilty of perverting the course of justice, but, and this is where it gets interesting, was not found to be linked to the accused, so essentially acting alone, not said to be linked with Vibes Cartel or any of the co-defendants. And so this is where things, I would argue, and the Privy Council would argue, that things went wrong, because essentially the judge at that point should have assessed whether or not other jurors were consciously or unconsciously impacted by the bribes. So either them now voting to find Vibes Cartel and co guilty, was that because they saw this juror X come and bribe them, thinking it was Vibes Cartel and co that had put them up to this, and then they overcompensated and thought, they must be guilty, they've even got somebody bribing us to make sure they're acquitted, because they have no faith that we'll find them not guilty, you know, of the proceedings and following the evidence. So there was that. Or they could have been on the flip side, which is less likely, but still should have been acknowledged or considered. But the judges didn't want to suspend the jurors at the end of such a long trial, because they were literally at the end. It was already one of the longest in Jamaican history. But it should have been the case that the jury should have probably been discharged, and this is what the Privy Council argued, so that there could be no mention of jury tampering or bribery. Now, in England and Wales, there's actually a piece of legislation that says you can discharge the jury if it's late in the day, trial-wise, and rule by judge alone. But in Jamaica, this legislation does not exist. So they would have needed to get a whole new jury, which obviously then would take you selecting the jury, swearing them in, and running the trial again, because they wouldn't have been present for the whole 8 weeks, 60 days of trial that had gone before. Now, this is where I kind of get confused, because if the laws in England and Wales are different to the laws in Jamaica, why is the Privy Council the highest arm of law in Jamaica if it just doesn't, like, seamlessly fit through? And the Privy Council are like, oh, why did you do this? You should have done it like this. This is how we do it in England and Wales. Oh, wait, you can't do that in Jamaica because the legislation doesn't allow for it, but we're going to pass a ruling on you anyway. I don't know if that makes sense to me. It must make sense to someone because that's how it's running, but I don't know if it makes sense to me. In fact, it doesn't. I'm also not a lawyer, so maybe I'm an idiot, basically. Maybe I'm just naive to the legal jargon and the rigmarole of the Jamaican / English / Wales / systems that are at play here. However, juror misconduct alone led to the misconduct appeals being successful. They didn't even get into the other two points of appeal, which is mad to me. I watched the Privy Council's summary and their decision, and they said, you know, if it was us, we would have done this and we would have done that, and the judge should have taken into consideration the impact this might have had on the jury and consequently on the decision they made. They appealed, as in Vice Cartel & Co. at the time, closer to 2014, appealed the ruling on this grounds that, you know, they didn't properly investigate the jury issues. The jury was forced to give a verdict really late in the day, actually, which allegedly posed undue pressure. And also there was a breach in the Deception of Communications Act, in which they used information from Digicel for the benefit of the prosecution. And I think that would have been like telecommunications information, so texts, calls, messages and that kind of thing. Those things didn't even really come up with the Privy Council. They said, obviously it came up in the big conversation they all had, laying down the points of argument. But in the summary, they didn't even get into it because they said the juror misconduct alone should have been enough. And so they have essentially ordered for it to go back down to Jamaica's courts. That's their recommendation, that's their ruling. But the UK Privy Council have overturned that conviction. Obviously, for Vice Cartel and his co-defendants, his, you know, situation at the moment remains unchanged. He's not necessarily a free man. However, it's a positive step in the direction to having the conviction overturned, if that is what is to eventually happen. The thing is with this juror situation is it's actually really bad because, you know, part of the legal system is to be tried by a jury of your peers. That might be an American thing, but it sounds good. And so if there is misconduct within the jurors, who are essentially the ones that are going to say guilty or not guilty and vote on it and deliberate, and they also didn't have a long time to deliberate. They made a decision very late in the day and were forced to push out that decision rather than, you know, going over to the next day and continuing conversations. It should be a just and fair system, realistically. And I think this is where points were being raised about Jamaica being able to take on and run and go through cases that are so complex, especially in this case where the body was never found. And so a lot of evidence that would come from a body by way of, you know, how did this person die? Where were the wounds? You know, an autopsy might give you. There has never been a body found or recovered. So there is very little by way of evidence that can be given scientifically, forensically, because that just doesn't exist. And I think that's a very interesting point of this case and probably one of the reasons why it was shocking to people that he was found guilty when there was no body. Also, I think points were raised within the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council of the fact that the jury knew of this bribery. I'm going back to the bribery of Juror X. All of them were aware. All of them were told about this bribe. But the judge really did not consider what that might then do to the verdict. And I think that was, you know, great oversight for the judge. Obviously, easy for me to say, I'm not a judge. And the Privy Council kind of summed up in saying that in regards to the admissibility of the telecommunications evidence I mentioned earlier and the jury pressure in them obviously returning that verdict so quickly, they didn't actually offer opinions or findings on these issues. These issues could be addressed by the Court of Appeal in deciding on the matter of a retrial, since they were not expressly thrown out as reasons for the overturn. It could factor into why a retrial could be possible, and the date for the retrial will need to be agreed on, obviously, by the parties that are involved. But it will be interesting to see how this plays out as time goes on. It's most definitely not over yet. Vybz Kartel and co-defendants are not free, and the situation, as concluded by the Privy Council, suggests that appeals should be allowed. The appellant's convictions should be quashed on the grounds of this juror misconduct, and that the case should be remitted to the Court of Appeal of Jamaica to decide whether to order a retrial of the appellants for the murder of the deceased. And I think that is all there is to say about that today. So I hope you have found that interesting. I very much found the whole idea of the Privy Council and, you know, the alternative CCJ a very interesting conversation and something to listen to and to think more about. And this kind of colonial legacy and the overhang and how these things impact, you know, the everyday lives of Jamaican people today who have to find themselves flying to the United Kingdom to get their justice, get the justice that they're looking for and that they're seeking. I think it's very interesting, and I do wonder if conversations about Jamaica becoming a republic will see some rejuvenation. They've gone quiet in the past. You know, I'm following these conversations very intently. But they have gone quiet recently, and I wonder if, you know, conversations that feature the Caribbean Court of Justice and the justice system more broadly will be at play or come to the fore again. I assume maybe not right now. There seems to be other pressing issues going on in Jamaica at the moment. But it will be interesting to see how this trial pans out as well as other judicial changes in the future in Jamaica's future. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. I hope you have a wonderful week. Goodbye. That's it for another episode of the History Hotline. If you enjoyed it, please rate and review us on whatever podcast platform you listen to, or tell a friend to tell a friend. To continue the conversation, follow us on social media at The History Hotline on Instagram and at The History HL on Twitter. The History Hotline is hosted by me, Deanna Lynn Cook. Research and marketing done by Zakia Riaz. Production by Waylon Mackenzie Witter, and original music provided by Royal Sounds. Sponsored by Musetopia. History Hotline.